To speak to this and open the panel, allow me to introduce our first speaker, Mr. Mort Rosenblum. Rosenblum was the chief editor of the International Herald Tribune, as well as the chief international correspondent based in France for the Associated Press. He's also written a number of books, two of which are on international reporting. Mort?
I feel like I'm coming home here. This is great. The lovable bear. Every so often when my sat phone rang during some skirmish in some remote armpit, I'd answer, "Good morning, World War III." And it was never really that funny, but now it's not funny at all. I mean, I personally believe that World War III has already started, and we just don't know it yet because it's a little too much to fit into a crawl at the bottom of a screen on CNN or Fox. Iraq is only part of it, and not necessarily the biggest part. Before getting into this, let me just throw out a few cautionary thoughts before we get into the panel this morning. I mean, one, as Matthew just said, we have to nail down the obvious basic. Media and the slightly better press are fairly useless five-letter words with no more specific gravity than, say, the word stuff. I mean, if it's Baghdad, do we mean Anthony Shadid or Geraldo Rivera? Are we talking about a John Lee Anderson piece in The New Yorker, an inside outsider's view on built on carefully built sources and a flawless eye for telling detail? Or do we mean a local stringer for a worldwide news agency whose main qualification is that he can mingle in a crowd in relative safety? Both have strengths and weaknesses to consider, and each has a very specific and different purpose. Second, we have to look beyond the distorting forms of shorthand that all of us use to get through the day. At the more attentive levels in places like this where we put some effort into understanding news and its sources, we often outfox ourselves. And no, that's not a play on words. We're losing the language, like, what am I going to call you now that mother's a dirty word? I mean, outfox still is outfox. For instance, when I go back to my World War III thesis and mention a clash of civilizations, how many of us will automatically haul out poor old Sam Huntington? And that would be misleading. This business of shorthand labels can get nuts. Moslems, there's a billion plus people. Insurgents, terrorists, freedom fighters, all very tricky ground. But encouraged by a media, which depends on collective nouns and short phrases to convey broad meanings, most people get lost in the underbrush. A quick for instance, not long after that 9/11 that we'll all remember for a long time, I got into Afghanistan, and I spent a month, 5 weeks or so, and I came back and via Hawaii, don't ask me why, but I was flying into L.A. at about midnight, and I had a car meet me to drive out to Studio City, and it was, one of these out-of-work L.A. actors, a cool guy, really, really interested in world affairs, it seemed like, and I'm kind of faced with a dilemma because I was really raggy tired. And I thought, oh, man, this guy really wants to know, oh, it's my duty as an informer of the world to tell, I said, all right, so what the hell? I said to the guy, well, yeah, I just got back from Afghanistan, because he'd asked all these questions about Iraq. I just got back from Afghanistan. He said, oh, yeah, well, let me tell you what's going on. And he spent the next, I'm not kidding, as Dave Barry would say, I'm not making this up. He spent the next 55 minutes telling me what was going on in Afghanistan, did not ask me a single question, and the end of it was, well, like I say, it's all the fault of those Arabs in Iran. And I'm going, oh, okay, but let's get back to World War III. My take on this came from a conversation with Aida Cherkis, who you may or may not know. She's AP's incredibly smart and courageous correspondent in Sarajevo, who is the backbone of everybody's Bosnia coverage. And we were talking on the phone about those editorial cartoons in Denmark, the prophet with an explosive turban. I mean, just consider the reaction 3 months later and some of the ramifications. I mean, wholesale deaths in Nigeria, as Jacob will know. I mean, Libya and riots in Southeast Asia, these are places where implied insults on a symbol in a newspaper would not on their own provoke such violent reaction. That's on one hand. On the other, you've got fierce insistence by Western editors that however sensitive some communities may be about certain things, nothing outweighs their right to fair comment and free expression. It's not a question of right and wrong, but rather what is. And the problem is we have these great bodies of uninformed humanity easily stirred by their leaders, whether religious or political. I'm talking most notably about wide areas of the Third World and also the United States. In a lot of societies, harsh government control restricts media opinions. Illiteracy and poverty further limit access to useful news. That's their excuse. What's ours? This morning, I mean, this is just for starters. I mean, just this is just to throw out a little few thoughts and see if we can raise some dust. We've got some a really good list of people here in Lost Notes. We've got a really good bunch of people here. Charlie Sennett is a real reporter out doing stuff in a lot of places, and he's going to sort of give you a real good hit of reality, followed by Jacob Silverberg, who used to be here pretty recently, and is out there doing the same. Mark Summers will give you a very close-up look at some of the scary stuff that's going on in Africa. And I can tell you, I've been doing this for 40 years. I mean, I've been, you know, probably 200 countries, God knows. I don't know how many wars. I haven't counted, you know, how much peace. Boring. But the scariest I've ever been, I mean, I don't even have to think about this moment, is driving from Kampala to Entebbe. And there was nothing particularly going on. It was just one of those moments when things were a little scary. And I got stopped at a roadblock by one of these Kidogo, one of these kid soldiers. And he was probably 8 years old, I mean, I'm guessing. And he had an AK-47. I mean, you know, it's a little Kalashnikov. They're not very big, but it was taller than he was. And I rolled down my window, and he looks at me, and he's got this Kalash pointed at me. And he's just looking at me. And I mean, you know, I'm staring into the eyes of this 8-year-old kid, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, his genetic programming and his environmental training and his motivations, and I'm trying to click onto it, because if I don't, he's going to hear some command from some elder he respects, squeeze his right finger, and I'm, you know, red shit all over the side of my window. And so I talked to him, and I tried not to show domination. I try not to show fear. It's kind of like, you know, dealing with a rabid dog, you know? And, you know, I don't even know if we exchanged any words, and he kind of looks at me, and I kind of looked at him and tried not to blink, but tried not to stare. And then he finally puts the gun down and goes, go. And I went, not again. You'll hear from Mark more about this. But, and finally, we're going to wrap up with a guy who's been a hero of mine forever, Benji Pogren, who was a very courageous and very smart editor in South Africa back when we used to call it Hate Land, and has seen all the changes over a long period of time, and now works out of Jerusalem, and is sort of an educator and a thinker, and I'd say a grand old man, but, you know, we're pretty old. What the hell? We both got gray beards. What the shit? And anyway, so there we are. So, you know, raise questions, yell at us, scream, argue, growl. Yeah, if I can remember. I started out in, I grew up in Tucson, and I went to the University of Arizona, where I'm now teaching now for a couple of months. I teach a course every year in international reporting. And in my sophomore year, my professor dropped a note on my desk that said, you know, anybody in your class speaks Spanish and is stupid enough to work for the money I'm not going to pay. I mean, he ran an English language paper down in Venezuela, and I was like 17 then. I applied for the job and got it. So, you know, at 17, it was the first democratic transition of presidents that Venezuela had ever seen since Bolivar, I think. And here I was out on the balcony with Raul Leone being inaugurated president of Venezuela, with the president, myself, and Penny Lernu of Copley. And I thought two things. One, whoa, this is pretty exciting. And three, Jesus, if they assassinate him, I wish they'd wait. Anyway, then I went back, finished school, went to work for the AP in 65. I was working for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. I started working for the AP in 65. They sent me to Newark, which was my first foreign assignment. And I was there for a while. And then I went out. Actually, I was in Boston. It was very funny. I was visiting my sister who lived in Revere Beach. And I got hold of a bad oyster or something. And I took the train back to New York, and really, really, really a mess. And I collapsed into bed. And I was in bed about a half an hour. And the phone rang, and it was the foreign editor in New York saying, You're going to the Congo. You're going to be our Africa correspondent. And I said, when you got to leave? And he says, 3 hours. You have to be in Washington to get your visa. So my packing was, I had a roommate. My packing was, all this shit's yours. And I got in a cab and I raced down and said goodbye to the woman I was going with at the time and said, I'll probably see you in about 3 years. And I went out to LaGuardia and I got a plane for Brussels, which is where the Congo Control Bureau was. And I went to London. I went and talked to London. I went to Brussels. Got on the overnight plane to Kinshasa. I still hadn't slept. I had like 2 hours from barfing into the, you know, anyway. And so I get to the Congo, and I'm there. It's like 5 o'clock in the morning. There's a war going on, and I'm a war correspondent. I'm like 22 or something. I had no idea what I was doing or what I was supposed to do. So I went out and talked to some people, and I went to the local news agency, and Mobutu was giving a speech then. He'd just come in power. And so I put together, you know, I don't know how what I'd call it, a good story, but it was a long story, which is good enough for an agency. And I filed it, and I got a lot of copy off that day. But while I'm writing, you know, back in those days, this is not anywhere near prehistoric, because we used to use Morse code, but back then it was telex. And I'm punching the story out on telex like this, and they've got a guard in this little tiny telex room. And he's dandling this Belgian FN machine gun, and he drops it. He's wildly drunk, and I mean, the place stinks, and it falls open on the clip. Bullets are spinning around. He's jumping on these bullets with his hobnail boots. Fortunately, they're center fire. And I look, turn around, and I look what I'm typing, and it's just total gibberish. You know? And I mean, I'm like totally scared shitless, you know? But it was really good, because that was my first day as a foreign correspondent, and everything else has been downhill, you know? Anyway, so I was in the Congo for a while. I was in Nigeria. I covered the end of the Biafra War. Benji remembered, if nobody else does. And I got a pretty good break again. I mean, I was up all night, and I'd heard Ojukwu say on the radio that he was going to, you know, have a message for people. And so I'm staying up all night. I'm listening. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, they announce, you know, Ojukwu gets on the radio by tape saying, well, I've gone in search of peace. Good luck, guys. You know, essentially, I've started this war. I've got a million kids dead, and I'll work it out. So I went racing over to the Nigerian telecoms, where I had liberally encouraged people to help me out. And I got a story off. I got typed off the bullet and all that kind of stuff like that. And all the power went dead for the next 4 hours. And when the power came back on in 4 hours, my rival at UPI and his the rival at Reuters and everybody else had about 15 rockets saying, you know, we're going to hell's your story, you know, blah, blah. So they gave me after that for my as a reward for, you know, and I was covered Southeast Asia, based in Singapore, and I did Vietnam at the same time, and then, you know, lots of stuff. And then from there, I went to Argentina, if I'm not skipping something. Then I did covered all the dirty war stuff in Argentina. That's another story. Ask me that sometime. It's really interesting how that came out, but we got a panel to do. And then in Argentina, I applied for a Nieman and a Council on Foreign Relations fellowship, and I got them both. I was really, you know, decided it was really fun. So I took the CFR one because I figured I'd be in New York and I could talk to. Well, anyway, did that for a year. Then I went back to the AP. This was 77, and my boss says, "Well, welcome back. Do you want to? You know, I'll give you a month to decide whether you want to go to Spain or France." And I said, "I'll tell you in the next breath." And so I was in France. I ran the AP and the French-speaking world, and then until age 79. Then they asked me to be editor of the Herald Tribune. I did that for 2 years until they started blurring the lines between editorial and advertising, so I made them fire me, and we won that fight. And I, back in 81, called up my boss again at the AP, and he said, "Welcome home, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I want to cover the third world." And he says, "What about the first and the second?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." So from Paris, since 81, I covered, you know, pretty much all sorts of stuff. And I tried to find stories that, you know, weren't headlines at the time, like the Soviet Union breaking up or, you know, Saddam with his, you know, long story. And then in 2004, AP dies. That's another story also. And so I made a career change decision. And meantime, I've been writing books and stuff. So what I'm doing now is I'm hanging out in Paris. I'm doing things that I really like to do. I'm essentially trying to help train a new Generation of Foreign Correspondents. I'm teaching every year for 2 months at Arizona. I'm writing books. I've got a new one, which I've talked to some of you about, that I'm working on now. I'm doing some assignments, some serious, some like a month in the Caribbean for Caribbean food for Bon Appetit, which was a tough one. Anyway, sorry. You shouldn't have asked.
I just say one thing. I think Mort comes out of that era of foreign correspondence, Western correspondence of the Congo, which was enshrined in a famous book, the title of which is Anyone Here Been Raped and Speak English?
Exactly.
Right, well, next we have Charles Sennett, who's the foreign correspondent for Boston Globe, and he has been both in the Middle East and the London Borough Chief, and has been reporting on the politics of fear for several years, having covered everything from the civil conflict in Northern Ireland to the war in Iraq. And his books include Cradle and Crucible, History and Faith in the Middle East, and The Body and the Blood, Middle East Vanishing, Christians and the Possibility for Peace. At present, he is an Eamon Fellow at Harvard University.
You want to just leave it? I'll click it, okay. And it'll go. Can you have it so just the picture short, not the whole? Yeah. Thanks. Hi, sorry. Thank you for having me. I want to really thank Sherm for giving me a call and asking me to take part in this. This is it's really an incredibly exciting program, and I'm every time I end up interfacing with this swirl of energy that goes on in that Epic House, I feel like I'm so relieved to know that those of us who are out there actually covering the world have people who are interested in it and young people who want to do that kind of work. Let me just introduce myself. I am a foreign correspondent for the Globe, and I've covered the Middle East for the last 9 or 10 years. I've had different postings, but most of my time has been spent in the Middle East. There's been a real journey for me personally covering and reporting on fear. It's a long journey because it's really been my whole career as a journalist. But I wanted to just really quickly back up and start with sort of that question of agent of fear or agent of knowledge, as the introduction asked us to ponder that. I know for a fact I've been the first. I try like hell to do the latter. I don't think we in the media succeed often enough. My journey reporting on fear begins at a tabloid newspaper in New York City, where I worked for the New York Daily News. I was a street reporter covering a different climate of fear and a different war. The fear then was crime, and the war was, quote, on drugs. And an equally flawed war, I would argue, as the one we're covering now on terrorism. And I want to bring it up just because when I was reporting in New York City for a tabloid, I know that that tabloid wasn't an agent of fear. It was machinery of fear. Every day I was a crime reporter on the streets of New York City in a very bold, brash, black and white tabloid. I don't know if those of you know the Daily News, not to be confused with Murdoch's New York Post. The Daily News was actually back then, I think, a really gritty newspaper that cared about its city. But we were so into the machinery of fear that it was undeniable. And while I was reporting on the streets of New York City one day, I heard an extremely loud bang in Lower Manhattan. And it was 1993. It was February. I had covered the Gulf War for the Daily News, but really, I was a street reporter. And when you hear a loud bang and a lot of sirens, you know, your job is to kind of put down your like hot dog at Sabrettes and go find out what's going on. And I did that and went to see smoke pouring out of the parking garage of the World Trade Center. And I had a friend who was a very mischievous tabloid photographer who carried Con Edison hats around so you could get into these scenes. We put on the Con Edison hats, and we walked into the smoke. And, you know, this is an elemental lesson of what it is to report on fear, but you are constantly going into the places everyone else is running from, whether that is Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel-Palestine, or smoke pouring out of a basement of the parking garage of the World Trade Center. I mean, that's reporting on fear is also about going right into the fear, right into the smoke and maybe fire, but trying to do your best to get as close as you can to where that fear is and what it's about. There's a famous definition of what is a foreign correspondent, and someone said, well, since the days of cavemen, they've been the guys who go with the torch into the cave to see what's in there, even if there's a very loud growling sound inside. When I did go in there, we all thought it was a generator explosion, very innocent time in America, and they strung the lights, the emergency crews strung the lights, and I was there for this moment, which I think is a very compelling moment. They hit the power for the emergency lights, and there was a four-story deep crater. And everyone was very quiet. And over the hum of that generator, everyone just said the same thing. It's a bomb. I mean, it was just so obvious that it was a bomb. What else is going to blow down a hole like that? And we pretty quickly realized that terrorism was going to be a big story. This set me on a journey to do street reporting on a crime against New York City. A crime against New York City, not a war on terror, but just a crime in which people were killed in an act of terror. And I went to deep into the Middle East, really, for the first time in my life. I said I'd covered the Gulf War, but it was kind of a thin experience, personally, because it was sort of in the covering just the military. I didn't know much about the region. I went into the Palestinian territories. I went into Egypt to follow Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the funny guy with the blind Egyptian cleric with the weird Santa Claus hat. Remember, I don't know if you remember him. He was the spiritual leader of this cell, or so we thought. And anyway, this was a big journey, and it ended up bringing me to Khartoum in the Sudan, where I covered a conference on global Islam on the periphery of doing street reporting, which is to find out who were these guys who tried to blow up the World Trade Center by setting a truck bomb in the parking garage. Who were these guys, and why are they so mad? How do you go from being a taxi driver in Brooklyn to wanting to take down the tallest building in New York City, two of the tallest buildings in New York City? So that question that kind of emerged out of the ash and smoke after 9/11 of why do they hate us was a question I think I was trying to get my hands around back in 1993. Noble reporting, I get into this global conference on Islam, and there's a very tall man in white robes who is, there's a lot of commotion around him. He has Egyptian bodyguards. And I lean over to another journalist I was with and said, who's that? And they said, I don't know, but everyone calls him the Emir. We find out he's Saudi-born. He's about 6'4". I remember perfectly that he looked like a praying mantis because he had these weird short hands and this very long legs. It's unique to be 6'4" in the Arab world. And it was Osama bin Laden, as I later learned. This was nascent al-Qaeda coming together. This was a global approach to what they considered a war, even back then, to fight a jihad against those who were conspiring to hurt Islam as they saw it, or who they felt were occupying Saudi Arabia at that time, America, American troops in the land of the two mosques. Anyway, that journey was very eye-opening. I learned a lot. I think I was really stumbling into something important. And then my newspaper got a hold of all this reporting I did. And as Mort or anyone on this panel will tell you, that's when your attempts to be an agent of knowledge can often get mechanized into becoming agents of fear. And that is exactly what happened. A bunch of reporting I was very proud of was shrunk down, really beaten up, big graphic things called Sword of Islam. That's what they wanted to call the series. I fought like hell against that, and I won on Seeds of Terror, which I still think isn't very enlightening. And in the end of this whole experience, right the day before publication, I went to our new editor at the Daily News. He was a Fleet Street guy. And I asked him, you know, I think we've destroyed this series. I really want to hold it. Why are we doing this? You know, and I'll never forget this. He just, and it was a moment where I actually sort of maybe even related to the IRA on some level. With his British Fleet Street accent, he said, "No one really cares about terrorism, mate." And I just remember, I just went to black and I quit. I quit the Daily News. And it was a great moment in my life. I won't tell you what I said to him, because that wouldn't be polite. But it was really a thrilling moment. And I just bring it up. It's sort of a long story, but it sent me on a journey, basically. A very good friend and editor, Matt Storen of the Boston Globe, found out I had quit, called me, hired me to be a special projects reporter for the Boston Globe. Boston is my home. I was thrilled to come home. And I have been at the Globe ever since. And very quickly, Matt sent me to be Jerusalem bureau chief, where I covered the Intifada, where I covered a lot of the Israeli-Palestinian attempts at peace, the kind of height of when we thought that was really going to happen, and then the plunge into darkness and the return to the second Intifada or uprising. I did a lot of stories there, I was pretty proud of my work. I think we all worked hard covering the Intifada. I think we did do a lot of explaining. But I also, at the same time, was on this journey covering fear with my family. My wife, Julie, and I have four boys. And they were all born abroad. They had never lived in America until we moved home very recently. And so we were experiencing reporting on fear as a family living amid fear. We were hearing the bus bombings, and on our favorite cafe was blown up. Where we ate pizza was blown up. There was a Hamas bomb in the parking lot next to our son's school. And a piece of the brain landed in the kid's school parking lot, and they were picking at it with a stick when the teachers kind of scurried them away, and all the, we had to come and pick up the kids and get home. I would commute into Gaza and watch a 15-year-old boy have his head blown off for throwing a rock. I mean, yes, there were clashes. Yes, there were things flying around. And yes, people get caught in crossfire. But this really was a conflict where you saw these unbelievably jarring images of young people having their heads blown off in a clash, of bus bombings where you had to really walk over human matter to cover your story. And it was horrifying. And finally, when this incident happened with the bomb near our son's school, we decided that we really had to leave. We had had a beautiful moment where we had a son born in Bethlehem. We had one born in Jerusalem. And then we just decided this is just too dangerous. We are in love with this place. We love these people, Israeli and Palestinian. We have deep friendships. We feel guilty about leaving, but we got to go. So we moved to London on September 5th, 2001. And I thought, I am out of the Middle East. Thank you. I'm going to get a nice blue blazer. I'm going to cover diplomatic news. I'm going to do what Mort gets to do in Paris, like hang out in cafes on expense accounts. And I was like, hello, London. So that's my idea of a foreign correspondent. Okay. And I'm going to have to move along. But I wanted to say that on September 11th, I was listening to the radio because we were just unpacking our boxes. And I heard September 11th on the radio, which was a uniquely horrifying way to hear it, actually, as someone who loves New York. But I knew the second I heard it, I knew that it was a continuation of that story that I did when I was reporting in New York City, the first attempt on the World Trade Center. I knew that this was bin Laden. I knew that we were on that trajectory. I don't say it to say that I was prescient, because I don't think I was, but I knew it was a part of a continuum for me, part of a journey of reporting on fear. And it's impossible to describe all of these intimate moments in that journey, but I wanted to share one day with you, if I can. Do we have time for this?
Yes.
It's about 3 minutes. Okay. If I can do this right now. Let's see. If we click there. Can you click on this stand here? Yeah, and then you can just click it. This is October 3rd, 2001. As soon as I heard about September 11th, I knew I'd be on my way to Afghanistan, and I was, reporting on the first war of the 21st century was more like covering the Civil War, as you can see, I was on horseback as a reporter because it was the only way we could ford this river, the Cauca River, to get up towards Talakan front lines where we believed the first bombing would happen. We were waiting for the U.S. airstrikes at that point, which would start on October 7th. Reporting on this incredibly frightening moment had these aspects to it, which you never get in the paper. What I'm showing you is a day in the life of my reporting as photographed by a woman named Eva Zimova, who was my friend, who just decided, I'm going to give you one day in your life. Those are the images you see in the newspaper, the military, or maybe you see other things. What you don't see is us struggling with a sat phone, or what it's like to kind of hang out in a trench and be as afraid as those guys that there are 3,000 Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces across a hillside. This is them calling in air coordinates to do very kind of primitive shelling, essentially. And you know, while you're covering that, you can go down the back of the hillside and run into these kids. And every one of these images is from that day and what we saw on that day. And I'm going to come back to these two images in particular, this one and that one. That is Bashir, who is a Taliban prisoner of the Northern Alliance, our ally. I was traveling with the Northern Alliance, these guys, and one of these young men had a Russian sniper's rifle. And he said, look, you can get a sense of the terrain. You know, the Taliban were up on another hillside across this barren terrain. He said, do you want to see your enemy? And I said, yeah. And he handed me the sniper rifle. And I looked through the sniper rifle, and Eva clicked this photo, and I'm kind of horrified by it, that I actually even picked up a gun like that. But in the corner of the screen, Mort mentioned John Lee Anderson and his beautiful eye for reporting. That's John Lee behind me, if you can see his face. And when I looked through that scope, and this gentleman, Osman, 25-year-old Northern Alliance officer, said, do you see them? Do you see those people who did this to you? It's like this moment that I will never forget in my life. I have a very dear friend, Neely Casey, who was killed. She was in the first plane into the first tower. And I, for a moment, just let myself think about her. I thought about where I was. Remember, go back, October 3rd, 2001. It was a horrifying moment to be that close to our, quote, enemy, right? I mean, all of these things were reduced down very simplistically for me. And I just, for a moment, entertained the darkness of what it feels like to think about revenge. It's a real dark hole, and I worry about our country going into it. And as a human being, as a reporter on the front line, right at that moment with Eva Zimova, my friend, snapping this photograph, I really was in that darkness, just personally, for a little bit. Now, I, of course, did not shoot. For one thing, to shoot is to give away your position, and then what does that mean? There are five of us on a hillside and 3,000 of them or so, they said. I didn't count that many, but what does that mean? That's stupid. You know, what would it have meant if I shot? Beyond the fact that I never would because it's not my job, I would never contemplate pulling that trigger in reality. I allowed myself to think about it for a second, but I'd never do it in reality. We have a military that is there to protect us. That is not our job. I've never been embedded. I don't believe in it. And I basically think that is a fixed point for me that I constantly refer to. And I said I would sort of come back to these images. I won't because we don't have enough time. Bashir, the man in the hole, is the Taliban prisoner who we're supposed to be afraid of. He was a pathetic figure in rags, put by the Northern Alliance in about a 12-foot down hole, and kept there by throwing an old Russian tank tread over the top. And it was medieval in its cruelty. And the way they treated him was medieval. And when I hear about the reporting that's been done about Bagram and about Abu Ghraib and about torture, you know, I think about this day and I think about that man and what does that mean if we allow ourselves to go so deep into that hole of revenge that we start doing things that betray everything we're about. And this day of reporting is extremely important for me in the sense that I never forget it, and I try my best to bring it to what we do. But I'm going to tell you, and this will be for Q&A because I've taken up way too much time already. We failed. We have failed to be agents of enlightenment or knowledge. We have failed to ask the really hard questions for a lot of reasons that we can get into. And I think we need, as the media, to remember that our job is to bring light, not fear. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Sennett. Our next panelist is Jacob Silverberg. Despite having graduated from Tufts in 2002, Jacob Silverberg has already worked as a photojournalist documenting social issues and conflicts from Sudan's Darfur region to Turkish Kurdistan to much of West Africa, and at present is the only Western photographer based in Iraq. He is also an alumnus of the EPIC program and of the Institute's China program.
Hello. Whoa. So I'm a photographer. I work now in Iraq. Before, I worked in West and Central Africa. People have talked about the media, whether it's an agent of fear. We've had a lot of guns. We've had a lot of stories about getting shot at. I'm going to show some pictures, very few pictures about guns and people getting shot at, and I don't think we have a single picture of a firefighter, an explosion, or something blowing up. People are afraid of many things. And I'm going to try to show fear in a couple different ways. Just a minute.
Jacob, can I ask you a question? Why are you the only Western photographer in Iraq?
Iraq ceased to be sexy in somewhere around late 2004 with Najaf and Fallujah. I think that I can't speak for all the media. I'm not an expert in the media. But from where I sit, it looks like people in America, people in the world want to understand what's going on in the world. And you want to pick up the newspaper and read a story that explains what's going on. You want to read that Charles Taylor is an agent of badness in Liberia, and that if he were removed from power, Liberia would be a better place. And so you have lots of stories about fighting in Liberia and the siege on Monrovia and the efforts to overthrow Taylor. And then Taylor goes into exile, and now he's gone. But Liberia is not a wonderful place. The story becomes very complex after Taylor leaves. And reporters want to understand the world as their readers do, and if you can't understand it, it's very difficult to write the story. What I do is I go to places that I don't understand, and I try to take pictures that say, I don't understand. It can be very frustrating. It's taken me a long time, and I'm still learning how to kind of emotionally accept the idea that you don't understand what's going on around you. And that's, I think, an ungratifying position for readers and for reporters. It would be great to show up in a country and interview the U.S. ambassador and interview some experts and have them explain it to you. And then you write your story and you explain what's going on. But what happens when you go to the experts and they just don't know what's going on? They have their ideas and their theories, but it's too complex. It's too mixed. It's too nuanced. Yeah, that'd be great. So this is your sort of semi-classic fear picture. It's a wounded soldier. This is a female soldier, an Iraqi woman, on her way to work. This is an Iraqi soldier taking a break in a house. The idea is that Iraq and West Africa are complex places. the whole world is a complex place, and there are moments when things seem clear, and we all love to read about them. But if you don't know what's going on, then how do you tell the world about it? And that's something I think all reporters probably struggle with. These are, this is specialist Robert Leonard. He's from Arizona. Robert was hit by an IED while driving a Bradley. For those who are not in the military, that's basically a small tank. People in the military will say, absolutely, it's not a tank. These are Iraqi soldiers watching Saddam on trial. Are they afraid of Saddam? I don't know. He's in American custody. He's in a court trial. Are they gratified that he's been arrested? Sure. This is a man talking to... This is going really fast. Maybe I can just hit advance as it goes. I don't know. This is a great one. I'll talk about this. This is great. Or this one. Perfect. Thank you. So this is a man being questioned by a U.S. soldier. Is he afraid? I don't know. Is he a terrorist? I don't know. If he's a terrorist, is it because he planted a bomb, or is it because he is Abu Musab Zarqawi? I don't know. Zarqawi was arrested once by the Iraqi army, but they didn't notice it was him. Go to the next one. Can I do that? Yeah. These are Marines having breakfast. I think so. I talked with some of the EPIC students about this picture before. What's going through the woman's mind? I don't know what's going through her mind. I don't know that if I talked to her for a week, I would understand what was going through her mind and what's going through her son's mind, what's going through the Marines' minds. You know, 3 days before the largest IED attack, the largest roadside bomb attack in Iraq occurred, and a third of the men in their unit were killed. I would think that they're afraid too. These are Nigerian men on a beach in Lagos. Lagos is a city of fear. People are afraid of their government. People are afraid of foreign companies. People are afraid of crime. People are afraid of poverty. People are afraid of disease. And these people are trying to kind of find a relief from that in religion on a Sunday on a beach. Another, this is a Nigerian woman at an overnight revival ceremony. She's, you know, trying to find salvation, trying to understand what's going on in her own world. These are school children. You know, what are they afraid of? This is a neighborhood that burned down, and a child running through it scavenging wood. Is it a poor neighborhood? Well, sort of, it's a poor neighborhood. Are the people happy? Well, maybe they're happy. Did it burn down because of evil? Did it burn down because of arson? Did it burn down because of poor construction? Did it burn down because of lack of development? Did it burn down because the country is a member of OPEC and produces a tremendous amount of oil, but the wealth from that oil isn't shared among the people? Nobody blew up. Nobody shot anybody. There were no suicide bombers here, but people are afraid. This is a man who is afraid that someone is going to sell his house for him, that he is going to go to work, and while he's at work, someone else will sell the house, and he will come home and find someone else living in it. And he will say to the new occupant, "This is my house, why are you here?" And they will say, "What do you mean this is your house? I just paid a man for it." This is a child who is Muslim, who was killed in intercommunal fighting in central Nigeria. It's about 60 miles west of where the fighting was this week. There's a massive tension between Muslims and Christians in West Africa. Is it about religion? In part. Is it because the Muslims come from the Sahel and they are cattle farmers and they need land for grazing and they move around, and the Christians happen to be farmers and they're sedentary and they don't move and they're competing for space? Yes. So this boy was hit in the head with a machete. Should he be afraid of Muslims because they believe in Muhammad, or should he be afraid of cattle herders because they need to graze? These are fishermen competing for the biggest fish in the lake, in the river, excuse me. This is the traditional industry in the area. This is the traditional way of fishing. They each have their nets and they have a gourd. They have two gourds. One gourd they float on, they hollow it out, gives them a little buoyancy. And the other gourd they put the fish into. The winner of the contest caught a fish, it's, you know, 150 pounds. And what does he win? He wins a minivan so that he can become a taxi driver. Because he's the best fisherman. But is that a better future for him economically? Is he less afraid that his children will grow up in poverty with the minivan? Probably. This is the capital of Nigeria's oil industry, this city. And this is a man who's washing his motorbike, which he uses as a taxi, in a puddle. This is where 2.25 million barrels of oil go through every day. Is he afraid of the oil companies because they may cooperate with the Nigerian military to kill those who interfere with the oil production? Sure. Is he afraid that the oil profits are being robbed by the people who have nice cars and drive home at night? Sure. These are children who live in a fishing village and an oil pipeline burst and it flooded the swamp with crude oil, and now they have to walk through the crude oil to get to the fishing grounds. Do they hate the oil company for having the oil pipeline and ruining the fishing ground? Sure. Why did the pipe burst? Was it sabotage? Was it somebody from their village who blew it up because they resented the oil company? This is in southern Chad. Chad is one of the poorest countries in the world, not because of war and not because of conflict. Sierra Leone tends to show up the lowest on the UNDP list of poor countries. They've had a civil war. Chad is not in the middle of a civil war, and it's not in a post-war. Chad is a landlocked country with a lot of sand and a little bit of oil. And these are SLA rebels in Darfur. Are they afraid of Arabs who've come on horseback to kill them because they're Africans? Are they afraid of their government who wants to kill them because they are aligned with another rebel movement that wants to overthrow the national government? This is a Darfuri woman waiting for food. This is a warehouse full of food. But there's violence between the rebels and the government forces and those aligned with the government forces, so they can't distribute the food. These are two children who are living in a dry riverbed before anybody noticed that they needed food. And maybe that's the end. Thank you.
Next, we have Mark Summers, who's the Associate Research Professor at Humanitarian Studies at the Center for Human Security at the Fletcher School here at Tufts. And his book, Fear in Bongoland, Burundi Refugees in Urban Tanzania, was recognized with the 2003 Margaret Mead Award. And Dr. Summers is a specialist on children and youth at risk, conflict negotiation, and education in war and post-war situations. In the context of our panel, Dr. Summers will be discussing the propensity of the media to mislead through negative portrayals, particularly with a focus on African male youth. It's completely up to you.
Can you see me from here? Okay. Thank you. I was thinking, listening to the journalists. I'm not a journalist. I have been to many places in Africa, Kosovo, Latin America, where I am with journalists and have had a lot of conversations. It's a very different perspective than I have to some degree, although there's some intersections. There's a former colleague of Charlie Sennett that used to be a friend of mine, Elizabeth Newfer, who's passed away, who did, before she went to Rwanda, drilled me with a lot of questions about ethnicity and violence in Rwanda, which I hope helped.
Killed in Iraq.
Yeah. Right. So, okay. So the question that I been asked to talk about, it's comes from a piece, much of it anyway, comes from this piece that this
Excuse
paper.
Mark, I'm being told that you're not on mic for what we're recording.
I'm not on mic. So I should go over there.
No, just pull the microphone.
I should go over there. Okay. Somebody boss me around. Thank you.
The Institute has an Elizabeth Newfer Fellowship. It's a $7,000 fellowship that we organized with the International Women's Media Center and the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. It's been taken now the last two summers by a Tufts student. If you're interested in it, we will have internship applications available. She's to spend the summer. She was a very good friend of the programs.
Wow. Yeah, some lady. Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was just mentioning that some of this is coming from this. There's a paper, I have a few copies that were sent to me called Fearing Africa's Young Men, The Case of Rwanda. And you, I think you can get it on, if you Google Fearing Africa's Young Men, I think it should come right up. Anyway, the cases that I'm going to talk about very briefly is how and why African men are seen as so fearsome. Now, we've heard references to males thus far as rabid dogs and as praying mantis. I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack in the description. This is a fear, this is a dominant emotion with reference to young men in Africa, and I would say also for the Middle East, that there's something about the large concentrations of young men which is seen as particularly terrifying and very, or at least, unnerving. And if we, just a couple of pieces of background on Africa and Africans in the American media. As an Africanist, these are things that are of interest to people like me, and it appears that in terms of the very limited amount of news from Africa that gets into the media, that war and insecurity makes more news than peace and successful peace building and development and things like that. And so perceptions, for example, one would hardly know from reading the news that most of Africa's conflicts are either over or in the process of ending, such as Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Mozambique, Angola, South Africa, Southern Sudan, and Burundi, Liberia. Current wars dominate. There's a good reason for that. But that is the perception that if you're talking about the receiver receiving limited amounts of news, it's a limited perspective. It's a limited view. And so current wars dominate, such as Darfur and in Congo right now. Curiously, Somalia, which is still in conflict, is not in the news, nor are sections of northern Somalia, which have been in relative peace for about a decade. And so limited reporting appears to have narrowed what is thought of as newsworthy with reference to this issue of what we learn about Africa. And leading the way in this perception, in these images that come out, are young men, quite often. And one consequence of this, and this is an unintended consequence, right? There isn't much room in the news in Africa. If you go to World Briefing in the New York Times, quite often you'll find a number of stories on Europe or on Asia, and sometimes none on Africa, on the whole continent. For the day, there's no news that's worthy, that's fit to print. So there are other perspectives. There are other kinds of stereotypes. There's the one of the African as the victim of AIDS, of corruption, of human rights abuses. And then again, the counterforce one is the pervasive one for young African men is that they're violent, they're angry, they're irrational, they're not very bright, and they're scary. So this is what the second one is what I wanted to talk about. Now, when you go to a city in Africa and you land at the airport and you take a taxi to your hotel, 9 times out of 10, you're going to see along the streets people walking. And you're going to see, particularly in the thick of the middle of a town, lots and lots and lots of young men. There was an extremely influential article written by a journalist named Robert Kaplan. And it was called The Coming Anarchy, and it came out in 1994. There was a follow-up book called The Ends of the Earth. He's a polarizing figure and has a fondness for predicting the future. And this book, this article, and then this book is very much about that. Now, I want to say that Africanists tend to attack Robert D. Kaplan, really completely, which I think is unfortunate because Kaplan, one of the things he did with this article in 94 is call attention to two phenomena that Africanists and others have been overlooking. One is urbanization. It's the only area of the world where urbanization is skyrocketing, and more than half of Africans, we have this picture, one of the stereotypes is Africa is rural. People live in villages. Within, I think it's 20 years, more than half of all Africans will be living in cities. And the rate is actually very high. The other is environmental degradation, which is going on in very, very, very quickly in many places, such as with reference to two places mentioned earlier, Liberia and Nigeria. So, key themes from this approach of the coming anarchy is that it's you can see the future if you look in poor countries now. And he uses the case of West Africa and especially Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, in particular. And his view in his description, things are coming apart. Traditional cultures are losing their influence. States are weakening. There's chaos, banditry, and open warfare on the rise. And this is all encapsulated, in his view, by young men in cities, whom he calls out of school, unemployed, loose molecules. They're not people. Loose molecules in an unstable social fluid that threaten to ignite. And he sees healthy kids at one point and just says that their health and good looks makes their predicament sadder. He really pictures it, promotes a picture of terrifying male youth, and this issue is, this perception is carried to the present day by people who support what's known as the youth bulge thesis, which is based on a demographic phenomenon that has younger groups of people. It's defined as extraordinarily large youth cohorts relative to the adult population. But I should point out that the focus is on young men and not young women. Young women are seen as silent carriers of this dangerous demography because of their fertility. The short answer given to why youth bulges are so dangerous and potentially volatile is, this is a quote from one of the authors of these studies, is there's too many young men with not enough to do. The thesis is actually, it's not really based on an argument, but a close statement containing an unsupportable premise, in my view. And it's the following. If young men are inherently violent, and you have to actually accept that in this assertion, in this thesis, then high concentrations of them inevitably lead to massive violence and even warfare. And one commentator puts it together and says that angry young men are driven to violence by their very biology. Now, what's important to note here is that it's not all young men that they're talking about. It's primarily young men in Africa and the Middle East. And there, some have raised that there's a connection to these theories that came out of analyses of poor urban areas in the United States in the 1960s. One was known as the super predator theory that talks about young men. I have it. Okay. And what's also interesting to note about this thesis is that it's frequently hammered home by members of the United States security community, many of whom are connected to federal intelligence institutions. John Helgerson of the CIA is one of the main proponents who gives speeches about this. And some of them, George Tenet would be another, some of them directly quote, cite Robert Kaplan in their presentations. So if you take this together with Kaplan, there was mention to Samuel Huntington, the youth bulge proponents, it makes people afraid of young men from these areas of sub-Saharan Africa. Four quick comments about this. One is that nearly all wars in Africa emerge from rural areas, not urban areas. The idea that the prediction that Kaplan has is that Africa's wars are going to come from urban areas doesn't seem to have much evidence thus far. Also, it's not as if the presence of young men in cities is new. Some cities in Africa were founded primarily by young men. They were the primary residents of Nairobi, for example, as it grew up. And in response to the assumption that young African men are inherently biologically violent, which underlies, it's kind of an implicit assumption, there's a recent study that suggests that early adolescent males with high levels of testosterone in their blood are easily influenced by their peers. If they're surrounded by peers engaged in delinquency, they are likely to copy that behavior. However, if they're around those engaged in positive activities, they're likely to become leaders. Finally, young men may be moving to cities in huge numbers because they lack jobs, the development, and because the development and employment policies have failed them. And there is a critique of this which says that there's looking at young men as being dangerous. One of the reasons why they're in cities is because the government policies and international aid has undermined their situation in rural areas and left them unemployed. So some final thoughts. If Kaplan and the youth bulge proponents are so correct, then a better question is to ask why young men, given their situation, are so peaceful. If you read some of this analysis, it actually is surprising for someone who spent a lot of time in African cities why most African men, young African men, have nothing to do with this stereotype whatsoever, even in the poorest parts of these cities. A second point is that they're depicted as a security threat and not members of the marginalized demographic majority of these cities that require inclusion, a chance to play a role in civil society, and support. And I've written elsewhere that the central irony of African cities is that the youth that dominate they demographically dominate the city, and yet they act like an outcast minority. So the question, I think, is to ask why people are so afraid of these young people, of young men. instead of why young men are so inherently fearsome. And finally, it's this depiction of these young men as angry and threatening in places like Africa and the Middle East, which helps distort the underlying problems that male and female youth confront that are not at all of their making. Thank you very much.
He was the editor of the World Paper, now is the director of Yaakov Center for Social Concern in Jerusalem. And without further ado, I'm going to have Pogan take the panel.
I expected to speak sedately for about 10 minutes and then answer questions. But knowing EPIC and knowing Sherman, I should have known better, because there's always surprises at EPIC. And as I sat down, as I came in, I was told, in fact, I'd be asked to sum up at the end and try and pull various strands together. And that, of course, is one of the wonderful things about EPIC, that surprises do happen. I took part the other night, for those of you who were there, those of you who missed it, missed the most extraordinary evening, a South African evening. How Sherman and his colleagues got together a range of people like that is in itself, and I know South Africa very well, to get killers from both sides together on the same platform and mediators, and to have them sharing their experiences with an intense emotion was really a most remarkable evening. And thank you for that, Sherman. I think we all learned, I certainly learned a huge amount, even about the country where I spent most of my life. I lived most of my life in South Africa and in Israel. I've been in Israel the last 8.5 years. And both those countries are characterized by the fact that a considerable number of people hate the press. And that's because the media publish things that most people don't want to know about and would rather prefer that these things haven't happened. So it's a particular joy this afternoon to be with colleagues from the press, particularly Mort and Charles. Charles, I know, from Israel. And it's a reminder to me, which is worth having every now and again, that in my long life as a journalist, I've been fortunate to know wonderful, talented journalists, courageous journalists, who, as Mort was describing and Charles, put their lives in danger to report the news. These are serious, committed people who write honestly and do their best to report on very tangled, uncertain, dangerous situations. And I'm very privileged to be with them on this platform. Charles actually reminds me of, when he was talking, a friend of mine, the late Adam Raphael, who was in London and represented CBS Radio. And Adam told me the story going back years when he was in Vietnam, and he was in some forward position one day with a group and a platoon of U.S. soldiers, and they got word they were going to be attacked. So he said the lieutenant in charge instructed his men to dig trenches, foxholes, and to get into them. And he came up to Adam holding a rifle, and he handed him and said, "Yeah, get in that foxhole and get ready to defend yourself." And Adam said, he drew himself up and said, "I'm a journalist. I don't carry weapons." And he said, the lieutenant said to him, "Look, when the blank, blank Viet Cong come through here in the blank, blank middle of the night, they're not going to stop and ask you if you're a blank, blank journalist. They're just going to kill you." And Adam said he took the rifle meekly and spent the miserable night in the foxhole. No attack came, luckily, brooding about the ethics of journalism and whether he should carry a gun or not. Now, we're talking about the politics of fear. And fear, we must remember, is a healthy emotion. It's crucial to our survival, for humans and animals. When we are faced by a dangerous situation, fear fills our minds and our bodies, and we react by taking avoiding action or by eliminating the threat. And fear has always been with us, it always will be. The trouble is it's also been used since time immemorial by leaders to drive people to act in the way that they want us to act. And in recent years, this phrase has come about, the politics of fear. The fact has always been there. Now it's got a phrase, just as human rights and conflict resolution. And I was doing conflict resolution and human rights before the phrases were known. Now I know what I've been doing all these years. But it's basic to us, and the media is obviously, whether it's television, radio, newspapers, is the channel for conveying fear or what leaders want us to do. So basically the media aids and abets the dissemination of fear. That's in the nature of the media. And in doing so, the media is simply doing its job of reporting. And in South Africa, for example, when the Afrikaner Nationalists came into power in 1948, there were three great dangers that they were propounding. And they were the Swart Gevaar, which was the black danger, the black majority. This is the for the white minority. There was the Rooi Gevaar, which was the red danger, the communist danger. And there was the Roomsa Gevaar, which was the Catholic danger. They were Calvinists and they hated the Catholics also. And over the years, they propounded this fiercely. And we in the press reported them. And in doing so, in doing our job, we spread the fears. They attacked the press, and especially the English language press, and in particular my newspaper, the Rand Daily Mail, and we reported them, because that was our role. And in doing so, we helped to dig our own graves, and we knew what we were doing. But when the Prime Minister or Cabinet Minister would get up on a platform and attack the Rand Daily Mail, we had to publish it. And this confirmed the prejudices of most of the whites about the Rand Daily Mail, and led finally to our being closed down. It was a factor. We landed in strange dilemmas. There was this right-wing nationalist party, and then an extreme right-wing group grew up called the Stichte Nationale Partei, which was the Renewed National Party, the HNP. And they represented a racism which was totally anathema to our outlook. But we sat down internally and talked it through, and we agreed that much as we despised and rejected their viewpoint, in terms of news, they were a factor, and we had a duty to report them. So we agreed we wouldn't overdo it, we'd try not to underdo it, but we would publish them. Meanwhile, the Afrikaans press, which was a government press, didn't publish a word about them. And the other English language papers barely reported them at all. And we landed up in this very uncomfortable position that we were the only paper actually reporting this extreme right-wing group. And one of the events that occurred, there was a party meeting a big conflict, a big fight broke out, which was quite usual at white political meetings, between the Afrikaner Nationalists and their former brothers and colleagues in this extreme right-wing group. And as usual at these things, people were punching each other, they were throwing chairs around at each other. And we had a reporter there, Bosman Swanepoel, who told me the story. He was the only journalist there, and he was sitting at the front of the hall at a small table, the press table, the only one there. And he said while all this fighting was raging around him and chairs sailing through the air, he was sitting there just pretending he wasn't there and hoping no one would notice him. But in fact, he said, a huge fellow ran across to him, leaned across the table, grabbed him by the shoulders and lifted him in the air and yelled at him, "Wie is jy? Who are you?" And Bosman said, he said, "Rand Daily Mail." And he said, this guy just dropped him. And as Bosman fell into the chair, the guy said to him, "Sit, friend." Now, that story embarrassed us terribly. To be friends with the HMP was not where you want to be. But it's one of the dilemmas, because we were spreading their message in the cause of doing our duty. And that's a fundamental problem. On the other hand, it's not always as innocent or straightforward as that. The media, for sake of circulation, for the sake of readership, viewership, whatever it might be, plays up issues. And Charlie referred to the machinery of fear. Well, that sells newspapers. It gets people to watch. And that's a great dilemma also. And the problem is there are a lot of the media which trade on this, the tabloid press, particularly in Britain. If you look at The Sun or some of the New York tabloids, the two New York tabloids, I mean, the stuff that appears there can be hair-raising. Well, the question, of course, is can fear be manufactured out of nothing? And it can up to a point, but basically you need some kind of a cause. And then you take it and you develop it. And again, the problem always is where to draw the line. Because, as I say, it's something has got to exist so you can develop it and exaggerate it. Well, I saw a headline, for example, in the, it was a lead story I saw it on the internet a week or so ago in the New York Times. And the story was diabetes and its awful toll quietly emerged as a crisis. And this was an amazing story in rather unusual New York Times style. Begin on the sixth floor, third room from the right, from the end, swathed in fluorescence, a six-year-old woman was having two toes sawed off. One floor up, corner room, a middle-aged man sprawled, recuperating from a kidney transplant. Next door, nerve damage. Eighth floor, first room to the left, stroke. So it went on. And what they were saying was an estimated 800,000 adult New Yorkers, more than one in eight, now have diabetes. And what they say is within a generation or so, doctors fear a huge wave of new cases could overwhelm the public health systems. Well, I read this, and I was as scared as hell about this. And that was the whole purpose. Well, this is the New York Times, a very solid newspaper. So were they playing up a fear? Were they being responsible in alerting us to this great danger of diabetes? And these are dilemmas. I can't give you total answers. Had it been in one of the New York tabloids or in The Sun in London with a screaming headline, they were playing up fear. But here's a very responsible paper giving us information. And you can repeat that. I mean, you just look on the internet, skin cancer from The Sun. You name it. There are fear merchants all over the place. But are they, in fact, doing us a service? Is the media being responsible? And that's a line where it's not always easy to draw to know what is responsible and what is engendering fear. In the political arena, of course, the ultimate was Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, who played on fear of Jews, in order to launch the Holocaust and to kill many millions of Russians, gypsies, all sorts of other people. The Iranian president recently talking about wiping out Israel. The media reported that. That engendered fear in Israel. That's been a major factor. And the reports about what various Arab nations, Hamas and so on, want to do to Israeli Jews is a major factor in engendering fear and pushing people to the right. That has a direct bearing on the political situation in Israel. Well, the media has to report this. But in the process, you're also developing that fear. Where you hold back, I don't think anyone can lay down rules. You play it by ear as situations come. You've had it in this country. I mean, I just picked up among millions and millions of stories. You find one from the Washington Post, which I just pulled out from September 2004, where it said, with voters expressing anxiety about Iraq, nuclear attacks and threats of terrorism in the first presidential election since 9/11, Kerry and supporters are adopting Bush's strategy on playing on the public security fears and sometimes using incendiary charges to stoke them. So both sides were doing this. And in Israel at the moment, where we have an election looming on March the 24th, fear is a big factor. Again, there are so many clippings, but just one I picked up from the Jerusalem Post a few days ago. Netanyahu, who is fighting the contender for premiership and against Olmert, the successor to Sharon, and what he says is that he is warning that Olmert's government will give away the Jordan Valley, which Olmert, in fact, doesn't intend doing. It's one of the big policy decisions at the moment. But according to Netanyahu, Olmert and Labour would allow Hamas to control the Jordan Valley and leave both Israel and Jordan at risk. And he said, this land could be used by Hamas to attack us. We must stop it. Well, that's anyone who just looks at it coolly knows that's totally exaggerated. But that fear is being engendered. And security is a dominant fact of life. In fact, it's the overwhelming fact of life in Israel. And you play to security. And Olmert and company, meanwhile, have got to play that ball back again, because if they consider to be soft on terrorism, they're gone. So public fear is being built up all the time. Just to finally, just to end off very quickly, the some of the other people, the speakers today, have spoken about trying not to engender fear, to rather give a different image of situations. The problem is this. Television, radio, and newspapers, which say that nothing happened yesterday, no one's going to bother. People watch and read and listen because horrible things have happened. That's, I'm afraid, a fact of life. So ultimately, the people responsible for the exaggeration of fear, you the people, you the ones. The press wouldn't do it otherwise. It's the lowest common denominator. It's the cheapest, easiest way to build up circulation. There are people like Mort and Charlie, as you've heard, who don't like that sort of journalism. But they're forced into it, unless they choose highly responsible media. But then, like my newspaper, you might go out of existence. There are commercial imperatives. Well, you could say the media are so important they should be controlled by the state, which has been, is an argument that is advanced. And the classic example of those of you who know, you remember your Soviet Union, Pravda, the official party paper, told only party news, never stepped out of line. It doesn't work. The commercial press is almost like the bumblebee. And if you know the story that according to all the known laws of aeronautics, the bumblebee cannot fly. The bumblebee doesn't know that, so it flies. And in the same way, the commercial press, in a crazy sort of way that no one can quite figure out, and you get megalomaniacs who own newspapers and television stations, and people who own it for all sorts of strange and dubious reasons, but somehow it works. You can't even say why, but it works. And the problem there is to try and persuade journalists to be responsible, not to control them in the way that some people suggest. It's not the role of journalists to propagate peace stuff all the way. Journalists have got to report what's going on. But a lot of education is needed of you people, the many uninformed humanity, that Mort referred to, in order to enable the media to do a better job, perhaps, than it often does. Thank you.